Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Norachit Singhasini, Ambassador and Permanent Representative of Thailand to the United Nations. He'll speak on the topic, Diplomatic Challenges at the United Nations, an Ambassadorial Experience from Thailand. This program, sponsored by Creighton's Asian World Center and co-hosted by the International Relations Club Model United Nations team, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, March 1st, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Mr. Singhasini's remarks were given as the 2013 Distinguished Lecture presented annually by the Asian World Center. Here now to introduce the speaker is J. Christopher Bradbury, Interim Vice President for Academic Affairs at Creighton University.
Until his appointment as ambassador, he was Deputy Permanent Secretary in the Minister of Foreign Affairs since 2007. He served as ambassador to New Zealand, Samoa, and Tonga. In 2001, he was appointed Director General in the Department of Information and Foreign Ministry Spokesman, and then later, Director General in the Department of East Asian Affairs. He has served as Chief of Staff to the Minister for Foreign Affairs, having been given the rank of Ambassador and attached to the Foreign Ministry in 2000. He was concurrently, between 1994 and 1999, Deputy Director General in the Department of East Asian Affairs and the Department of International Organizations. He was previously posted in New York, where he was Minister Consul at the Permanent Mission to the United Nations. He has also held various other positions in Bangkok, including the Chief of the Office of Foreign Minister, having joined that ministry in 1979. As a graduate of Thailand's National Defense College, Mr. Singhasini earned a Bachelor of Laws from, I'm going to mess this one up, Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok. Thank you very much. The ambassador helped me on that one. And he also earned a master's degree from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University in Massachusetts here in the United States. He is married and has two children and also has relatives joining him here today. Please help me welcome our most distinguished guest, Ambassador Singhasini. Mr. Ambassador.
Sawadee krap, that's the Thai greeting. Dr. Bradbury, distinguished faculty members, students, distinguished members of the Omaha community, thank you for inviting me here, and thank you for attending this lunch. It's a pleasure to be here, and the topic that was so kindly given to me, Diplomatic Challenges at the UN, an Ambassadorial Experience from Thailand. It's not one of my doing, but suggested by Creighton, and I'm happy to go with it. The talk will be divided into three parts. One would be, as you can imagine, Thailand. The second would be something you may be interested in is the UN or the United Nations. And then on the last portion would be my own experience. But coming to a university, I couldn't resist myself. So we just have to start the talk with a quiz. Because Jose was telling me that he is supposed to teach a class today at 12:30. But he told his students that any of you who came to this talk will be given credit for having attended his class. So rather than just making it too easy on you and just eating and listening, it starts with a quiz, naturally, in a university. Well, the first quiz let me tell you, all there's going to be three questions, and all of them will be very easy. The first question is the first Asian country to sign a treaty of amity with the United States. A treaty of amity is like you starting diplomatic relations. You may have had contacts before with traders, with missionaries, Jesuits, I'm sure. But a treaty of amity means those two countries have started diplomatic relations, formal diplomatic relations. So we'll just leave it at that. The second question is, one country offered to send elephants to the United States as a gift as far back as 1861. And the third question of the quiz is, one Asian country fought with the U.S. in World War I during the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and later in Iraq and Afghanistan. And just to be clear, fighting on the same side. Fighting on the same side as the U.S. So without making it too difficult for you, the answer is Thailand. The first question is the Asian country to sign a treaty of amity, and you guess you would be asking yourself, what? Thailand? Not China? Not Japan? Well, it just so happened it was Thailand. We were called Siam at that time. We didn't change the name to Thailand until 1939 was when we changed the name to Thailand, in keeping with many other countries whose name ended with land. I think we had people going abroad and coming back and said, who knows Siam? So it was changed to Thailand, part of the change from the absolute monarchy into constitutional monarchy. So we signed a treaty of amity with the U.S. in 1833. So so you'll know, it was called the Treaty of Amity and Commerce, whereas the U.S. and China signed a treaty of peace, amity, and commerce between the U.S. and the Chinese Empire, which is known as the Treaty of Wang Gye, in 1844, so 11 years later. And with Japan, you signed the Japan-U.S. Treaty of Amity and Friendship, or the Convention of Kanagawa, in 1854. The second answer to the quiz of sending elephants, it was our King Mongkut, who some of you would know from the story The King and I, the Broadway play or the movie. He was king, and when we established diplomatic relations, when he learned from a captain of an American ship called the John Adams that you didn't have elephants in this great big country, he offered to send some pairs of male and female elephants. And the term he used was that they should be let loose in your forests, particularly tropical ones, and then you can tame them and use them. By the time the letter came, unfortunately, civil war had broken out, and the reply didn't come from President Buchanan, but from President Lincoln. And the reply from President Lincoln said, while thanking the king for the offer, said, the climatic conditions of the U.S. were not suitable. Moreover, the use of elephants as a means of transport was unnecessary, since steam on land and on water had been our best and most efficient agent of transportation and commerce. So no elephants came over. Otherwise, you may have some elephants down in Florida, and instead of the gators, you might have the jumbos. So the first part of my talk will be on Thailand. I think that will set a good background for you to understand where my country comes from and what I do and represent at the UN. Well, I'm sure you all know that we're a country in Southeast Asia. Many don't. When I mention Thailand, some people give me a quizzical look and said, Taiwan. I said, no, Thailand. And so it they're close together in pronunciation and both from Asia. So we're a country in Southeast Asia, and a country of 64 million people. We have neighbors on the mainland and also that are islands close by. And I make this point because while countries in Southeast Asia, you would know and recall the Vietnam War era, the Indochinese Wars, what happened in Cambodia, what happened more recently in Myanmar. But I just wanted to mention the positive aspects of it now is that there are no more major conflicts among the countries in the region. Those 10 countries that I was mentioning in Southeast Asia are now part of what's called the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN. There are 10 of us now, all at peace, and we hope to be one community by 2015, which is very ambitious. By one community, it means more closer together politically, economically, and culturally. It will not be one community as close as the EU. There will not be a common currency yet. And with what's happened, I don't know if that is coming. So at the moment, it's an association that was established way back in 1967. But at that time, Southeast Asia was divided into the five countries of Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand, Indonesia, and the Philippines. More what you would consider the liberal, democratic, Western-oriented countries as opposed to the communist-dominated or socialist Indochina of Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, and Myanmar. But at the moment, we are together in this Association of Southeast Asian Nations. These are our neighbors. We have land borders with Burma, or what they call now Myanmar. Laos, very close, and they could speak Laos, and us in Thailand would understand probably 80 to 90% of what they're saying. Cambodia and Malaysia. So it's a very diverse group. Of the 10, you have the Philippines, which is predominantly Catholic. You have Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar, and to a lesser extent Vietnam, who are predominantly Buddhist. Like in Thailand, 95% of the population would be Buddhist, probably 3 to 4% Muslim, maybe 2% Christians, Catholics, and Protestant. Next, I couldn't talk about Thailand without it putting in a pitch for the tourism authority. I can't go back to New York without telling them that I made a pitch for Thailand and Thai tourism. Bangkok has always been well known for its infamous traffic jams. We're trying to resolve that, and with the what you see are sky trains and the underground system, things are much improved. And all the more so that last year we had a record number of tourists in Thailand. The number was 22 million people, 22 million people visiting Thailand. So that was another record for us. We are a predominantly agriculture country. We always have been, and till recently, agriculture was our number one export, particularly rice, teak, and corn. Rice, we've always been traditional rice growers, although other countries like China and India would produce more than us. We've been the number one rice exporters because they have a big population to feed, whereas for us, we are able to export it. For the past 10 years, we have been the number one rice exporter, partly because of the climate and partly because of the policies of our neighbors. Take our neighbor to the south, Malaysia. They were growing rice, but now they've said they will not be growing rice. They are going for cash crops like rubber and palm oil. So together, we have been the number one rice exporting country in the world. At the moment, industry and production is high on the list. We are called the Detroit of Asia, basically because we have no policy of a national car. There is no national car for Thailand, but practically every car company you can think of has some production plant in Thailand. For the U.S., of course, there's GM, Ford, Chrysler Company. From Japan, you have both Honda, Toyota, Mazda, and the Nissan Dash Datsun Company. From Germany, you have Audi, BMWs, and Mercedes, all producing in Thailand and exporting elsewhere. So it's been a gradual change. Also, a lot of electronics and computer parts. If you don't think of China, then for Thailand, it's been one of those major foreign exchange earners. We had a big flood last year, and it affected the whole supply chain of car parts for the Honda factory in southern U.S., which is Western Digital, who produces all the hard drive. It disrupted the supply chain a bit. So this is the plug for the Tourism Authority of Thailand. In 2012, Travel and Leisure, through their survey, said named Bangkok as the world's best city. It was number one. For the ladies, you can look at the last line. It says, affordable shopping. But that I shouldn't be highlighting too much because it's not political appropriate. So everyone should enjoy shopping in Bangkok. The next is you know of our Thai food, but a few of you may have not heard of this particular curry. It's called Massaman curry, and CNN Travel last year also named it the top 50 most delicious food, and it was number one. It comes as a surprise to you with pizza coming in number two. I think that would come as a surprise. So that, I think, should give you a brief overview of the country. At the moment, those of you who follow the news would know that we have had elections. Next week will be another big elections for the governor of Bangkok, and you'll be having your mayor of Omaha election soon. But for us, it's going to be a big test because the two most likely candidates, one comes from the main opposition, who's the incumbent governor, and the other is from the present governor. So it's not only a test of who's popular in Bangkok, but it's a big contest between the two major parties in Thailand. Unfortunately, the political climate is still very tense, with the opposition and the government in power still at loggerheads on practically every issue. But I just wanted to assure you that on the part of our foreign policy and our relations with the U.S., that is not one of the contentious issues. Our relations go back more than 200 years, and it has always remained strong. During the time that we felt we need help, during the 50s with the communists coming down from China and all into Indochina, during the Vietnam War, the U.S. was a staunch ally of ours and continued to be so. And on that second point that I was asking you about, I think it's the third point on who fought with the U.S. We've always fought together in all the major wars. The only asterisk would be Iraq and Afghanistan. We were there with you. We weren't with you in the outset when you went in with your own operations. And at that time, I think President Bush was saying, either you were with us or against us. We were on the sidelines. But as soon as you made it a part of the UN operations, we joined. I think many countries were of the same view, that if it's part of the UN operations, we would participate, and that's when we did. So we went into Iraq and Afghanistan with you, a bit after you, but also with you. And that is not a sticking point. On the second part of my talks, which is the UN, I think many of you are interested because I'm being co-hosted by the Model UN Group, the International Relations Club, and Professor Morong's Asian World Center. So I think that may be an issue of interest to you. It's a very controversial issue here in the U.S. Is the UN worthwhile? Is it worth keeping? Are we paying too much? They are really our friends. And I think having served there twice and the current ambassador there, I would say, yes, it is not perfect. There is much that could have been done and should be done. But ultimately, it's the member states to decide. And there are 193 member states. When you saw that designation, ambassador and permanent representative of Thailand to the UN, I am one of 193 others. There are 192, just like me, representing other countries. So in your case, if you were following the news a month or two ago, my counterpart was Dr. Susan Rice. She was your ambassador to the UN and still is. She was at a time a candidate for the Secretary of State, but partisan politics being what it is, she has withdrawn her nomination as Secretary of State, and you now have Senator John Kerry as your Secretary of State. But that is what we do. Ambassador designates the rank that we are the representative of our country to another country, or in my case, to the UN. The permanent representative, I think, is, let me tell you, it is not permanent. You don't stay there until you die or you abdicate like the Pope. But the permanent side of it is something from history when the UN was established. The headquarters was established in New York, and you anticipated that there would be a permanent representative there in New York. And that is how it came about, rather than having people coming over from Capitol every time there is a meeting. We are there full-time, 365 days a year. The General Assembly Hall, which we meet every year, throughout the year, but the most hectic time is from September to December, which is the General Assembly session. And at the first 3 weeks is called Leaders Week. That's when all the leaders of the world, all 193, come together and talk. There is a general debate, which is opened by the President of the U.S. President Obama is always the third speaker on the first day of the debate. So you would see that televised on CNN and whatnot. And then that tall building is called the Secretariat Building. It's where the UN staff work. We don't work there. We all maintain offices all around the area. You can buy your office, you can rent your office, But when you attend the meetings, this is where you attend the meetings. Presenting credentials to the Secretary General, that's what you do when you first come and take office. Once you present your credentials to him, then it means you are officially endorsed. You can begin your work. And unless and until you do, then you're what's called an ambassador designate. And we do this throughout with every country. My colleague, who's ambassador to the U.S., does the same to President Obama. He would present his credentials, which is a letter from my king, saying, I've been appointed. I've appointed so-so as the rep, as my representative to your country. And that's what we do. Next is the General Assembly Hall. The importance of this assembly is that all 193 countries are represented. Every country has one vote, everyone being equal. But there is a catch that whatever the resolution or decision passed by the General Assembly has no legal binding. You have a moral obligation to follow it, but it is not legally binding. So this is one of the big questions in the UN of equality. But the more important organ in terms of peace, security, or what's happening in the world where you open your newspaper and read about it, what's happening now in Libya, the situation in Mali, in Somalia, the piracy, is dealt with by this smaller other body called the Security Council. And what's unique about it is it's a creation of the World War II, end of World War II era. It is comprised of 15 members. 5 are permanent members. The other 10 are elected and rotated for a time of 2 years each. I think you can name the 5. They are the victors from World War II. That's what those that don't like the Security Council would say. It is a legacy of 50 years past. But that's the reality. The 5 also happen to hold nuclear weapons. There are the U.S., Russia now, the former Soviet Union, now Russia, China, France, and Great Britain or United Kingdom. They are there permanently. They are the permanent members of the Security Council. The rest, you get elected for 2 years, you work there for 2 years, then you're out. For Thailand, we've been a member of the UN since 1946. We've been a member of the Security Council only once, in 1986-87. We are a candidate in 2016. But just to put it in perspective, out of 193 country members of the UN, 70 have never been on the council, never once. And among those, I would venture to guess that maybe another 50 don't aspire to it or would not get elected. They are these smaller countries who either don't have a real interest or with their small number of personnel would be hard-pressed to be on the council. And working on a daily basis, practically every day of the year for 2 years. You have formal meetings, you have informal consultations going on practically every day. Today you may be talking about what's happening in Libya, tomorrow what's happening in Mali, where the UN should be sending troops, what's going to happen with the Somalian pirates. All these issues are dealt with by this Security Council. And the elections is very competitive. Just to give you a sense, I think we had elections a few years back where you need to get 2/3 of the countries to vote for you. 193 countries, that means you need something like more than 120. And it was very competitive. When we were elected in 1986, we went around 7 ballots until we finally reached that threshold. And there have been instances where the number of ballots have risen to 100. You just kept on voting and voting, and no one won. Finally, I think a third country was asked or offered to be the compromise candidate and was finally elected. So that is the sense. This past elections 2 years ago, it was so competitive that the rumor has it that one country spent about $80 million campaigning, inviting people over to their country at that government's expense. So it has happened. The Security Council set up as it is now. You have the 5 countries that are at the head of the table, which are the permanent members, and then the rest, they are members to 2013. Then another 5 replaces them. And then on the other side, they are members till 2014, and then 5 more countries will replace them. They are divided into regions because that's the major regions of the UN. You have the Latin American group, you have the Western European group, the Eastern European group, the Asian group, and the largest group is the African group. So based on that number, the allocations of members into the group, you would have more or less based on the numbers of countries from that particular region. But more and more so, the UN is involved in social issues, the Human Rights Council. It is the highest body that looks into issues of human rights abuses, practices of countries. It is elected by us in New York, but then the work is transferred to our colleagues in Geneva. So they look after what's called the Human Rights Council. And this is another very competitive organ with the U.S. and the Permanent 5. They have no permanent seat there. So they have to be elected also. The U.S. was just elected the last time this October. So it is something that even a country like the U.S. needs to campaign for and gets your views known across and hopefully be elected, which is the case. We were elected 2 years ago, and we served as president until end of 2012. We were the president of the Security Council. So what do I do in that last portion of that topic, the ambassador experience? As I told you, I'm the representative of Thailand to the UN. And that means I deal with the Secretary General of the UN and all his staff and all the other officers who are in charge of various issues, from environmental issues, climate change, economic issues, Millennium Development Goals, which we have just completed, and also issues like when we supply troops to the UN peacekeeping operations. I would be dealing with the UN because we send the troops over, we pay the cost, then we are reimbursed by the UN, as all other UN members are reimbursed. But also, I deal with my 192 other colleagues. So what I need to do is represent Thailand, get our views across that these are issues that are important to us, and hopefully persuade them to support or be part of various groups or groupings within the UN. At the moment, water is an important issue for us. being an agricultural country, with the big flooding we had in Bangkok last year. So, for instance, I'm a small group of steering committee for water. And it's us, Thailand from Asia. You have Finland, and from the Nordic countries. You have Hungary from the Eastern European groups, and you have Tajikistan with me. These are examples of what we do. So basically, that's number one. And then all these organs that I was telling you about, which is very competitive. We are, as I said, a candidate for the Security Council in 2016, and in 2014, we are a candidate for the Human Rights Council. So that means a lot of lobbying efforts on my part, meeting my friends, the ambassador, making sure that he tells his government that Thailand's a candidate, if possible, to vote for Thailand. And if it happens to be the case that his government says it's up to you, then I really have to make friends with him. That at the end of the day, when the ballot comes, he would either write Thailand or take that box. So it's a very time-consuming but pleasurable job. So that, in a nutshell, is what I do on a daily basis. At the table we were discussing, and it's also very social activity is very important, because with 193 countries, each one celebrating their national day on a particular day, they have a reception, they have a cultural event, they have a concert, you are expected to be there. Because at the end of the day, when you have your own national day event or concert, you expect them to be there. And the only way you can assure that is you attend other people's. It's just like any family, because if you don't take care of them, they're not going to take care of you. So it's like a, I won't say a social club, but outside the normal operating hours, that's how we operate. So if I was told there was going to be a Q&A. Thank you.
Thailand's feelings towards its king and how everybody agrees on that?
Thank you. Just by way of explanation, I think our young lady there spent 2 years in Thailand, so she would know. Thailand has, throughout its 700-year history, been governed by kings. It was an absolute monarch. We had two capitals before we moved to Bangkok. One was in the north called Sukhothai, and then it was the other capital gained influence, and Ayutthaya was a capital for nearly 300 years, and it was finally sacked by the Burmese. So Bangkok has been capital for the last 200 years through one dynasty. Rama the First founded Bangkok about 240 years now, and that particular line continues now to Rama the Ninth. Rama the Ninth was born in Boston, Massachusetts. His father was a physician and studied at the Harvard Medical School, so he was born there. And he has now reigned for more than 60 years. He is the longest reigning monarch in the world. I think he started his reign a bit before Queen Elizabeth, but at that time he was still a minor. I think he was 18 or 19, so he had a prince regent, but officially his reign had begun, and he's now in his 80s. He has been one who, despite being a constitutional monarchy, meaning he has no role in governing. Our system of government is similar to the Westminster, where we elect members of parliament and senators. They in turn elect the prime minister. So the prime minister is the head of government. But the king is above all that. He is not elected. His line continues. There is a crown prince. There is a crown princess. So he is, in our terms, above politics. And for my generation and even before, since his reign for 60 years, we Thais have not known any other monarch or king. That's one part of it. The second part of what he has been doing throughout his reign, from that young age to practically about 20 years ago, or 10 years ago, when his health started to deteriorate with age, he has made it a point to visit practically every province, every small village and town in Thailand that he can manage to. And when he's there, it's not just saying greetings and all, but he really looks into what they really need. You would always see him with a photograph of a map in one hand, pencil in the other. If he goes to this town and the villagers tell him that they need water, he would work with the officials to say, maybe a small dam here, a small reservoir there. He does not order it. He is not in a position to. But with the respect that he has, that's what happens. And he has all these royal projects, which is, in terms of the U.S. experience, I could call it as a model project. He starts it on a smaller scale, and if it works, then government agencies could emulate that on a larger scale. So I think that is the main reason. Probably the third reason is because of all the changes in government that we have had. We changed from a constitutional monarchy, from the absolute monarchy in 1930s, when we sent aspiring young students to all the Western countries, France, UK, Germany, whatnot. They came back with ideas. And finally, we had a revolution, more like a coup d'etat. The king was stripped of his powers, and it was a series of elected governments and military strongmen throughout the Thai history from 1932 on, up until the recent past few years. We had thought coups, which the last one occurred more than 10 years ago, was a thing of the past. Then all of a sudden, about 5 years ago, we had another coup. But it was something which is, I won't say, I won't try to justify it, but if you were there in the region or in the country, you would see that it was not just that military. The sentiments in the country was, at that time, felt that the government was just, it had to go somehow or other. And it's something unthinkable here in the U.S. that the armed forces would take over, but that's what happened. So we always hope that that's a thing of the past, and we will have democratic elections, and that's what we did. So we've had three subsequent elections, and it's a civilian government
in power. If you ask me, will it last? I would say most of the Thais would hope so. But based on what has happened, when there is that great swell of discontent among the people, then let's hope it doesn't happen. So I think that is, in a sense, why there is that genuine respect for the monarchy, particularly this king. I think most Thais hope that it will continue with any future king. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Norachit Singhasini, ambassador and permanent representative of Thailand to the United Nations. He spoke on the topic, Diplomatic Challenges at the United Nations and Ambassadorial Experience from Thailand. This program, sponsored by Creighton's Asian World Center and co-hosted by the International Relations Club Model United Nations team, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, March 1, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Mr. Singhasini's remarks were given as the 2013 Distinguished Lecture, presented annually by the Asian World Center. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director for Public Relations, and Maurang Jang, Director of the Asian World Center at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.